I hope that's not a sign of things to come, Chris, but we'll see. All right. Last year, I don't know how many of you remember this, but Michelle kind of gave a testimony herself of kind of where she came from and, you know, how she arrived there. And, you know, shared a lot of the struggles that she had gone through as a child. And then really there was only a couple with me since we've been married. But anyway, one of them I think I do need to go over and talk about is in her reflection last year, she spoke of how she was no longer going to go along for a spiritual ride and how she'd made a decision to stop following a man and start following God. And what I decided to do today is I'm going to share in a little bit more detail about the ride that she was talking about, the spiritual ride, and about the man that she was referring to and, you know, not following a man. I described the ride that she talked about as like an amusement park at this point. It was not in the sense of fun, but along the lines of drops and twisting turns in our history and our spiritual walk together as a couple. I wanted this to be really lighthearted in nature, but it does pain me a lot to see the effects of the journey that it's had on my family and many of my friends here. So I'm going to just start at the beginning and talk a little bit about my growing up and stuff. And so I grew up as a practicing Roman Catholic, went to a Catholic grade school, and as a child I served the church in the role of a server. And for those who don't know, the role of a server is to perform tasks for the priest during the Sunday morning mass at funerals and during other days of obligation when the church services are held. One of the specific tasks of a server was to assist the priest when he administered Holy Communion. And now the Catholic Church, holds that the little wafer like we have for communion is actually transformed into the body and blood of Christ, or the body of Christ. The little wafer, it was considered sacred at that time when I was a child doing this, and the only person that was allowed to touch this wafer was the priest. And when the congregant would come up and receive communion, the priest would actually take the little host and put it on their tongue and say the body of Christ, and then he would actually place it on the person's tongue. And as a server, we were required to hold this little disc underneath their chin so that if it happened to miss their tongue, it wouldn't fall on the floor. And it was a major catastrophe if it did fall on the floor. But everybody stood back. The priest picked it up. But as I was older as a server, and I believe this was around the time of Vatican II, they took that away. The church determined that it was okay for the body to handle the host, to put it in their hand, and then they took people and gave them a little bit of training and then were allowing them to distribute the communion. And I always wondered what changed, you know, why did they determine to do that? At that age, I didn't really do anything more than determine. I didn't ask the question. So then when Michelle and I were married in the church and I was attending the Catholic church where we had been married, I remember asking myself, you know, why doesn't the church have pews in the Bible? If they hold to the Bible as being the Word of God, why don't they use the Bible? They have a little missalette thing instead. And I asked the priest this question, the guy that married us. And the response to me was, you cannot read the Bible like a recipe book. And stories like Jonah and the whale, and they probably didn't happen, but were told by men sitting around a campfire telling stories. And that just didn't... You know, because if that's the case, then what is true in the Bible? You know, it just didn't make any sense to me on that. So I pursued a couple other people in the Catholic Church and didn't really have any good answers. So I figured it was time to go out and start looking around. And I think my intent was really genuine in what I was doing, but the way I approached it really was bad. Okay, so Michelle and I, at this point again, were married. And so we're trying to figure out where to go in the Protestant church. And I went to a black friend of mine, and, you know, a good friend of mine, and he invited us to his church down on Hannah Street. And, you know, yeah, keep in mind, coming from the Catholic church where it's very ceremonial, very, you know, everything is kind of ritualistic. Man. So we were, there was a lot of dancing in the aisles and singing, and Meredith was probably about 1 year old at this time, I think. And Michelle's holding Meredith, and they actually came and tried to grab Meredith out of Michelle's hands and bring us down to the front aisle and start so we could dance around in the front. So we did that one attempt there, approached at that church one time, and then we left there. But that's just kind of a funny story, I guess. We tried several other churches during that time, really didn't find anything that we were interested in. I don't even know what that meant at that time. You know, what are you looking for, right? Well, I was working maintenance at St. Joe Hospital during this time, and a coworker encouraged me to start reading my Bible. And we would get together on our lunch hours and our morning breaks and read and discuss New Testament passages. And it was really a good time in my life. I really felt close to God, his word, enjoyed reading it. He invited us to his church, and Michelle and I started to attend there, and it was about a 50-member Pentecostal denomination. And the speaking in tongues part was different for me. I certainly didn't have the gift of doing that, but overall, you know, I felt like it was like a spirit-filled church and everything, and so we started going there, and after we'd been there for probably about a year, the pastor told us that they were going to have a street evangelist come in from New Orleans to talk, and he was a bodybuilder. Well, I was really interested in this, and I invited a friend of mine along to go because we were really interested in hearing what he had to say, but really about seeing how big he was and stuff too, you know. So everyone's sitting in the church, and the evangelist came to the front and asked the question, who in this congregation cannot speak in tongues? Now, like I said, I couldn't, and certainly my friend couldn't. We kind of looked at each other, but two girls, you know, raised their hands, and this guy came up and said, come on up, you know, we're going to get you speaking in tongues today. And again, that set with me is like, okay, if tongues, not really understanding tongues, but if tongues is a gift from God, as I read in the Bible, then how can a man just come up there and say, we're going to get you speaking in tongues? So again, I asked a few questions to this pastor. I didn't really like his responses that he came back with, so I dragged Michelle up and away we go again. So during the time, this time, we really weren't attending church, kind of disheartened with what we had seen. Meredith was about 3 years old, and Michelle and I were pregnant with Morgan. At that time, we'd exhausted all of our means for child care. I mean, we went through all of our friends. We had nothing. So we ended up having to go to the newspaper, which Michelle was really, and I were really opposed to doing that. But we did. And we found a husband and wife that were very endearing towards children. And Michelle and I felt very comfortable with them. And after a few months of watching Meredith, Meredith was coming home and wanting to say prayers at dinner time. And so we were both pretty intrigued by that. We started asking the couple where they went to church, and they told us they were Mormon. And I didn't know anything really about Mormonism, but I was really impressed with the couple's desire to be good people and the warmth they showed our young family. They asked if we'd be open to missionaries coming to our home to discuss the gospel. And while at our home, the missionaries would share the responsibilities. One would like be helping Michelle with the dishes or taking care of Meredith or playing with her. And the other one kind of did the lesson thing. And that kind of impressed me too. And we loved the structure that we saw in that. And when they started talking about the Joseph Smith thing, you know, as a prophet of God, I don't know how much you guys all know about Mormonism, but that one didn't really rest well with me. But, you know, the ideas like being married for time and eternity and having your family sealed with you for eternity was really, impressive to me. I really liked that idea, especially with having a three-year-old and a newborn son here soon. We were invited to the church service, but this idea of Joseph Smith was bothering me a lot. And so I went to the library and I got this book called Joseph Smith and His Mormon Empire. And I started reading that book, and I told Michelle, okay, I'm not going. But we were invited by this family, and we kind of felt obligated because he was taking care of our child and stuff, or they were. And so I remember sitting in the parking lot over there at the church and telling Michelle, I'm not going in. And sure enough, here comes Dick, the man. He comes out in the parking lot looking for us, and I'm like, oh, great. And so I did end up going in. We did end up going into the church, and that kind of began a three-year journey into Mormonism. Now, some would probably be asking, why, you know, 3 years in a cult like that, how could you do that? And especially after, you know, kind of reading your New Testament and all and being involved in that. But after reluctantly entering the church building, I made some pretty incredible observations in there. I saw teenage kids with their arms around their fathers and their mothers, and their some of the kids had their heads resting on their mom's shoulders. And I saw a lot of discipline and structure and a high sense of morality. And I really liked these things, and I really wanted to be a part of that. So we started going, and Michelle and I went through 1 year what they called investigators class, which taught us fundamental stuff. There really wasn't anything that seemed kind of weird about that at that during that time. And we were later baptized Mormon, married Mormon, had our children sealed to us for time and eternity according to their doctrine. And Michelle was given the role of head of the nursery over there, which was really, I mean, that was a big role over there. I mean, you know, Mormon families are just huge. So she had huge responsibilities and all that stuff. But I was given the roles of a Cub Scout leader and then taught 10, 11-year-old boys during Sunday school. And one particular Sunday, I was teaching the boys about the structure of the Mormon faith. And the lesson started with, okay, so Jesus is our foundation of our home, and Joseph Smith's is the walls. And I had to stop because here I am teaching these young kids something that I didn't truly believe in anyway with this Joseph Smith guy. I wasn't, you know, I just wasn't convinced. And so after that Sunday morning, I began to ask some of the sometimes, you know, the high standing, sometimes lifetime members of the church about their view of Joseph Smith being a prophet of God and how they came to that belief. And I received responses like, well, I don't know about Joseph Smith, but I really like what this church does for my family. Or, you know, Mark, you just need to stop questioning and start believing. And that just wasn't good enough for me. I didn't feel that that was appropriate or a good response at all. So I asked to be released from my calling as a Sunday school teacher, and so I could start attending the adult Sunday school class that they had. And went at the Mormon church, you have wards, they call wards, like Fort Wayne has two wards, and they would divide it on which part of the city you're in. But the president of our ward, I had to approach him, ask him to be released. He reluctantly agreed to my request, and I'm really thankful for that at the time that I did that, because the Mormon church goes through the New Testament 1 year, the Old Testament the next year, the Book of Mormon and Doctrine and Covenants the third year, and the Pearl of Great Price the fourth year. Well, they happened to be going through the New Testament that year, and I'd read it. So, and at the time, I think it was maybe even the first day that I went into the adult Sunday school, we were reading Romans chapter 7, where Paul speaks of not doing what he should be doing and doing that which he should not be doing. And they stopped and said, well, let's all go back to our LDS King James Bibles in the back and go through Joseph Smith's translations. I didn't even know they were back there at this point, but I went back there, and chapter 7 in Romans read something like this. I do what I'm supposed to do because that's what God commands me. That was Joseph Smith's translation. And so I'm like, what? You know, what's up with this? And then I found out later, as I was going through the Joseph Smith translations, that there's a lot of places in there that they actually tell you to delete this verse. So, okay, now I got all kinds of flags going up about the Mormon church with this. I called Hank Hanegraaff on the Bible Answer Man to talk to him. Told him I was ready to leave the Mormon church, but I didn't think my wife was ready. And he told me I needed to put God first. And so I told Michelle we were going to leave the church. And she was like, I can't leave the calling that I'm in right now. You know, there's so much responsibility in this. But I think she started asking some questions and getting some responses that I really won't get into right now. And she realized, too, that this was something that needed to happen. So along those lines, also at that time, my brother-in-law and sister-in-law had a ex-Mormon president come in and speak at their church, and he talked to them about where we were at and what we were doing, and we got we had a lot of conversations with him. And so we're ready to leave the church. We told the Mormon church we were leaving the church. We started in February, and it took us over 9 months to get our names taken off of church rolls over there. And in fact, they told us we had to actually go to Salt Lake City, Utah, to make that happen, because how do we know you're really you, and that type of thing. So anyway, yeah. So it actually took us 9 months, and it took us a lawyer's letterhead stating, you know, you will do this, and then they finally did. And our children's names also off of that. So at this point, Michelle was actually doing child care for some people at home. And we had some friends that invited us to their church. And they were good friends. We felt really pretty comfortable with them. It was just a non-denominational congregation. It was very open. The guy that we were talking to was an elder of that church. It seemed like a good body, a strong body of mature people. But after we'd been in the church for a time, we started seeing a lot more of it going towards a charismatic movement and Toronto Blessing. I don't know if any of you are familiar with the Toronto Blessing. And we had some missionaries that came back from South America basically stating that God had given them gold teeth and things like that. So, and then along those lines, when those things were happening, my daughter now, who is in the eighth grade, is attending the teen Bible study up there. And I asked the teacher what they were studying, and he had said, well, we don't really do a book of the Bible or a Christian author. What we're doing is I pick a word, and like love, and we all just let the Spirit lead, and we'll talk about love. So there were some other issues and problems with that, and we picked up and left again. Now, we visited a few other churches, but at this point, I was so frustrated with how, you know, I was approaching things and what I was looking for. Here we live in the city of churches, and can't seem to find anything that's making any sense, any logical sense. And this time I was doing some side work with a good buddy of mine. And he encouraged me to plug into a 12-week Bible study that was starting up in the fall. And I went home and I told Michelle I wanted to commit myself to the study. And she said, for some reason, she said, I want nothing to do with it. I don't really understand why she did that, but she. So I began the study, and I was introduced to basic apologetics and a test for truths. And I found out later that a lot of this information was stuff that Denny had put together. And to me, each week was more and more exciting, with precepts building upon precepts and seeing the objective evidences, the validity of the New Testament. And how I related this in my mind, it was like I'd been walking around in this forest trying to figure out, you know, where I'm going for a very long time, and I'd finally found the way out, you know. So I brought this newfound excitement home, and I was ready to once again lead my family, this time out of the dark forest, right? I said, this is the way out. Let's go. But this time, rather than taking my hand and let me lead the charge, I was met with hesitancy. You know? And it's kind of weird, because as I've gone through this and I put this together, it really opened my mind and my eyes to seeing this. And I don't know, for a long time, even here recently, I guess I'd never thought about how much of an impact that my past leadership had affected where we were at here. In my fervent passion, it never entered my thoughts of how my past spiritual leadership might affect this effort. My children were both in and near the teenage years and had thoughts of their own. I did not come beside them and ask them their thoughts, concerns, fears, and then patiently show them that they could trust my leadership this time. Instead, I pushed everyone hard to adopt the same enthusiasm that I had about this church, and after all, I was a spiritual leader of my home, right? When my family didn't blindly fall into line of my leadership, I interpreted their actions as rebellious, and I openly shared my frustrations with many people, including church membership. I want to summarize this chapter in a journey by saying that I carried this mindset about my family for over 10 years, and my pharisaical attitude could have come at the cost of my marriage and certainly with one of my own children. And if not for one of them showing the patience and love that they did, I don't know. I don't even know where I'd be. I don't think I'd even be here today, to be honest with you. I don't really want to get into a lot of the details behind that in that statement. I know that's a very large, broad brush of the 10 years that I'm talking about here. But I guess just in closing with this is I only want to say if it's by the grace of God that he's brought my family and I to the point of this point in our lives and where we're being here. I've learned a lot, but I still have so much to learn. But I do know that God's patience and his love endure forever, and I continue to ask him to open my eyes to what I've been blinded to and for his help in curbing my emotions so that I will continue to grow in a proper knowledge and mature love for him and for others. The final note I want to make is, you know, we're moving up to Columbia City, and there's been a lot of speculation, you know, whether we're going to stay or not because it's 50 minutes away or whatever. But the truth of the matter is as I've shared this with you guys, and I think about the aspect of going back and trying to find a sound body of believers again, I want nothing to do with that. And so the 50-minute drive is there and back is nothing compared to, I think, what tech offers and the safety nets and the things that are in place here that makes this a safe and a mature body. We're not going anywhere. So that's what I want to say. Thanks.
Mark took the pressure off me to make up for so much time since that third person isn't sharing. He also gave me that much longer to sit and shake a little bit. All right. I'm glad that Wendell, in his wisdom and obsessive compulsive-like preparedness, scheduled me for a Sunday when he knew that the church would be mostly empty. Except that didn't really work out. None of these people that went to Ash Bash were supposed to be here. And not only are they here, but all the lake people that I thought, they probably went to the lake for the weekend, they're all here. And then there's some visitors over here that didn't even get to hear Wendell preach today, so I'm sorry about that. But all right, when I asked Wendell what I should talk about, he said, "Why don't you talk about what it's been like adopting Ezekiel? Surely there are a couple verses that have sustained you through this time." And I was thinking, I've been terrified to use verses for fear of misusing them ever since we started attending this church. So, needless to say, I will not be sharing any scripture that might reveal my poor use of hermeneutics. All right. At the last Body Life Sunday, Lon Deal talked about having always been a steadfast Christian, having been brought up in a Christian home, and never having strayed from the path. He said that sometimes he felt disappointed that he didn't have a rock star testimony like so many of his peers at Taylor. While my husband agreed with this and he could relate, I was sitting there thinking, ugh, I have a rock star story for you. Just wait until I have to share. When Wendell gave me the yellow sheet of death, affording me the opportunity to be on deck for today's Body Life Sunday, my plan was to go for shock value. I was going to talk about growing up with an emotionally detached father and a lesbian mom in the tiny town of Leo. However, after I started planning out what I wanted to say, I realized that ultimately my chaotic childhood and adolescence doesn't define me or even have much bearing on who I am today. True, it affects my knee-jerk reaction to conflict and other things that I may not even realize, but it has not made me who I am. Who I am today is more about knowing Christ and making choices that are obedient to him. And just to clarify, my mom is no longer lesbian. After her 15-year relationship ended, she became a Christian and does not consider herself to be homosexual. In a book about womanhood, as part of a chapter addressing marriage, Elizabeth Elliot said, "When you make a choice, you accept the limitations of that choice. To accept limitations requires maturity." I've made many choices. All those choices have come with some limitations. Being a Christian is a limitation. One could argue that it's not limiting in a negative sense, but to others those limits seem unreasonable and undesirable. Being a wife is a limitation. Being a mom is a limitation. Being a stay-at-home homeschooling mom sometimes feels like a huge limitation. But our last decision to grow our family through a special needs adoption feels like the choice that will result in the most limitation and will require the most maturity to accept those limitations. We knew that it would be challenging to adopt a child with Down syndrome. The process itself is financially, mentally, emotionally, and even physically draining. We knew that bringing Ezekiel home would change our lives forever and require more giving than we feel comfortable or capable. However, we have seen others do this and felt that we could follow in their footsteps. We thought that if anyone can do this, we have the resources, the family support, the church support, and friends to help us provide a forever family for a special child that would otherwise be discarded or marginalized. Our first decision to adopt came with some limitations, and we have matured in order to deal with those limitations. We have seen through bringing Inara home that the limitations are worth it, and we are confident that even the choice to adopt Ezekiel will be worth the limitations. On Wednesday, June 18th, a well-respected specialist confidently diagnosed Ezekiel with autism. This is a new set of limitations, and I was quick to remind Ezekiel that autism was not part of my choice. If you're familiar with autism, then you know it's early to diagnose, since Ezekiel's not even two. Dr. Escobar seemed very confident in his proclamation and gave much supportive evidence. You may have noticed things that Ezekiel does, like his self-stimulating behaviors, his lack of eye contact, his avoidance of human connection, and some of the noises that he makes. I had gone into this appointment confident that Dr. Escobar would normalize all of these things and tell me everything was going to be okay. Yes, that's normal for Down syndrome, or this is expected given his history of neglect and lack of stimulation. However, this is not what he said, and what he did say, that's not Down syndrome, that's autism, felt like a major blow. I've really struggled to adjust and find a new normal during the past 3 months, and this just seemed like too much. I think I've known that things weren't normal since the first time we met him. After our initial meeting in Hong Kong, I came back to our hotel and bawled. I remember emailing Wendell about the emotional struggle, not quite confessing that I was actually entertaining the idea of getting on a plane and pretending the whole thing never happened, as if Nate would have let me. I was terrified that this adoption decision was going to ruin our marriage and our children. Wendell asked if he could share my email with the church, and my response was, no, I'm not sure that I really want the whole church to know that I'm disappointed that my child with disabilities actually has disabilities. Nothing has revealed my selfishness and immaturity in accepting limitation the way that adoption has. The limitations that come with the choice to be a mom and the choice to adopt special needs are many. It's difficult to admit how my selfishness gets in the way of good parenting. It's hard to muster the strength to respond the way that you should respond and not necessarily the way you feel like responding. It's a scary and helpless feeling when the warm, fuzzy feelings don't come naturally, and you have to force yourself to respond, all the while being suffocated with guilt over feelings that just aren't there. It's then when comments like, "It takes a special person to do that," really make me angry. A, I'm not that special of a person, and B, it takes a choice, not a gifting or a calling. I was prepared for this lack of warm fuzzies part of adoption. I've experienced it before and to a greater degree. We know intellectually that these adoptions are good things. We know that we will grow in wisdom and maturity because of these choices. We know that our children will be better for the sacrifices being made. We even hope that these choices will be more of a blessing than a sacrifice. But sometimes it doesn't feel like that. Sometimes it seems to demand more than we are humanly capable of giving. It's these times when we realize that we aren't in this alone. We know that we aren't capable of doing this in our own efforts, but we continue on, drawing our resolve and our strength from the one we serve. It's then when we remind ourselves that this life is short, and sometimes call my mom and ask her to come get all 5 children. The daily reality is that we are tired and not always convinced we have enough to give. It can be a daily struggle to be mature and accept that our choices have limitations. While I can easily say to my children, it's not my job to make you happy, I'm finding it a bit more difficult to say that to myself. It's not my job to make myself happy. As a Christian, that's not the goal in this world. When we were making the decision to adopt again, I kept trying to convince Nate and myself that we would rise to the occasion. that even though the challenges would be great, we were more than capable of handling them maturely. I knew that there would be a transition time of finding a new normal, but that we would be okay in the end. I suppose it's not the end yet, so we still might be okay. You might be thinking that I have painted a pretty bleak picture of what our lives must look like. The truth is that even though we are a bit more tired, a bit more irritable, okay, maybe a little more than a bit sometimes, a bit worn out, we are still enjoying our family, and we are so thankful for the newest addition. When he smiles or makes even the tiniest progress, we rejoice and smile with him. He's a pretty great addition to what we think is a pretty great family. And he's cute. We are so thankful for the blessings that God has bestowed upon us. Our cup runneth over. Choice has limitations, and maybe the greatest choices come with the greatest limitations.